Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. It's Friday night, so we reload this week's news. One of the biggest stories, the overreported, the underreported, the winners, the losers. Which story sucked you down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will we remember in 5, 10, 15, 500 years from now, huh? 312-981-7200. We got two great Chicago journalists in studio tonight. Rumana Hussain, the assistant metro editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. Rumana, good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a while. I feel like the last time that we did radio together, you were covering the courts. You were doing criminal,
yep,
right?
Yep, and I just started working as a full-time editor about 3 or 4 months ago. So
congratulations.
Yeah, no there reporting anymore for a bit. But
all right,
I'd like to get back into it at some point.
Well, you gotta restart, right?
Yes.
You gotta like refresh a little bit, then you get back into it. Charlie Meyerson, I don't know if you've ever refreshed. You continue to work and work and work. Charlie Meyerson, and now the editor of the Chicago Public Square, which is the daily newsletter that tells us what's going on in the world, which is up for a Best of Chicago. And what is it?
Yes, Chicago site? Readers, Best of Chicago 2017. We're one of four finalists, which
what's
shocks me as much
what's
as everyone else. The best news site.
Okay, I'll go check out Best News Site, and then I'll see Best Cocktail.
That's right. And actually, we're a finalist in that category, too.
You are good. All right. Well, you guys are here tonight, and I appreciate it. So let's get right to it. Let's start with the biggest story of the week. Charlie, why don't you start? What do you think of the biggest story of this week?
I would guess the biggest story would have to be something that affects, you know, ideally much of the entire planet Earth, probably something that touches all of us in one way or another, something that crosses.
You can say it, Kathy Griffin. You can say it.
Yeah, Kathy Griffin, that crosses national lines, all hemispheres of the Earth. I don't know. Has there been a story like that this week?
So you think that the pulling out of the Paris Accord and climate change, Donald Trump making the decision on yesterday, right, at the Rose Garden.
Yeah, although it seems like several days ago.
Romano, this is a story that I'm surprised that everybody's surprised, because during the campaign, he felt like this was one of his continuing talking points. I think he brought it up in the debate that he didn't want to be involved. And he's been talking about less global, more America first. But this week, it seemed like everybody came out like, what?
Yeah, I think the fact that he actually did it was probably like shocking to people. And I think the actual like commentary that he made at the news conferences where he said, you know, I'm indebted to the people of Pittsburgh rather than the people of Paris.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's been a lot of jokes about like, I guess, Earth last, America first. So I think it was just kind of just him listening to him talk about it was what shocked, I think, a lot of people. Not that anything's shocking anymore.
He's done this again and again with big announcements, you know, reality TV show. I'm going to make my big announcement. He's done it. He's said he's going to, and he allows the suspense to build up around him. And then he makes the decision that everyone at the beginning expected him to make.
Okay. So this we've been talking about on the show. We had Michael Hawthorne on the other night talking about this. And the idea that this is a non-binding, it's not a treaty, it's an accord. There was a lot of talk about this being socialism from the right, or this being a treaty that Obama kind of went around to Senate and went around the way that the Constitution set up. So good on Trump to take away. But this was really an effort to bring the developing world to the table to say we really have to do something about climate change. And it seemed like there was no sort of right or wrong, that everybody was in agreement. So, I mean, am I missing the story here that there's something nefarious about everybody coming together and trying to take on something like climate change?
I guess, you know, his whole thing was this hurts the United States. That was his big thing. And, you know, he seemed to be talking more in terms of like isolationist America and, you know, talking about the mining industry. So I think he made it seem like it's something jobs, whereas it's actually about how the Earth's temperature is rising and all these countries have agreed that let's reduce our greenhouse gases, like our uses of that. But I think they just don't want to. I think his administration doesn't want to focus on solar, wind, and natural gas, energies.
Those were big, big items. How much of this was erasing the legacy of his predecessor?
Maybe. That's one I can't answer. But I've been accused in the past of being overly optimistic under circumstances like this and others. But, I haven't ruled out in my own mind the possibility that out of this could actually come some good. We've already seen in the days, in the hours since the president made his big announcement, a number of states stepping forward, California, New York, Washington.
Washington.
And another state just joined, and now I can't remember which one it was.
Sure.
Saying that they are going to adopt the protocols on their own. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of a line, I think it was Samantha Bee who said in another context several months ago, states' rights, it's not just for racists anymore. So out of this could come a new level of responsible behavior, a new level of authority taken by the states, taken by municipalities. Oh. Mayor Emanuel this week said Chicago is going to continue with commitment.
And you know, it's consistent.
And it might filter down to the individual level, which is, all right, the government isn't going to save us. And this is, of course, the libertarian mindset, right, and to some extent the conservative Republican mindset. The government isn't going to save us. We're all on an individual basis going to have to do things like, you know, buy non-polluting vehicles and we'll
let the market
see.
Determine where we go. And there's something to be said about that, at least in terms of consistency, because we saw with the federal budget proposal, a lot of when we talk about cutting social service agencies and other agencies, the what the budget director in the office is saying is, no, this is for the states to decide. If you want to fund certain social service agencies, do it at the state level. The government, the federal government's going to get out of it. So at least that's consistent to what we're
seeing.
Yeah,
and I do think it's, you know, making people a little more aware. I mean, it's definitely people making people more activists in, you know, different fields and making people aware of things. I think Rahm Emanuel, just a couple of weeks ago, whatever was taken down on the EPA website, he put back up on, you know, the city website. So I think there's a lot of people, you know, watching very carefully, and which is good. It's making people more
active. On today's Chicago Public Square, and I read it.
You read it?
I do. And it's got a great link, and this is important, I think, for the history to understand politics. This is, as much as everybody wants to make it seem that Donald Trump is out on his own and he's isolated, and all of his administration and all of his people say, oh, what are you doing? This is almost carbon copy of what George W. Bush did in 2001, where he said, we're not going to be in Kyoto. Like, they pulled out of what Clinton and Al Gore had set up a couple of years before. So this isn't new territory necessarily when it comes to Republicans and climate change, global climate change.
Thank you for reading and for signing up at ChicagoPublicSquare.com. I really appreciate it.
But I mean, there's something to that. Yeah, right.
Well, and again, it would be nice, I think, in my personal opinion, if President Trump had decided to continue the nation's commitment. But in the end, you know, this is more going to be about what corporations decide to do, what consumers decide to do. And we've already seen some companies, Apple Computer, for instance. And of course, Elon Musk said he's making a break with the president on behalf of his companies. The marketplace may bring some pressure to bear for companies to say, we are green, you know, we are Paris Accord compliant, and that becomes a selling point for some people.
Is there any concern, and you hear this a lot in the criticism of the move, the political move this week, that this gives wiggle room or an entryway for countries like China or India or others to take a leadership role and to essentially put pressure, economic pressure, do the exact opposite of what Trump is talking about, where they go, you know what, we're going to invest in solar, we're going to do this, and nobody wants your coal anymore, and we actually lose as a country?
I think so. I think so for sure. I mean, what countries aren't part of this agreement? I think it's Syria, Nicaragua, and the United States. And, you know, you look at countries like India, they have been using solar power and they have been doing all these different things. So I think, you know, there's a lot of smart people in India and there's a lot of scientists in India. So they probably are looking at things and, you know, it definitely will change.
And
I mean,
and
you know,
China too, right?
And a lot of those students in those countries are definitely better in science and math. So
China,
I mean,
just in the last,
and they're not
years,
coming to the United States because we've told them we don't want them.
Yes,
here.
There have been stories about how in India people used to see this as a place to come, and now people don't want to come.
And
anymore.
We've seen it: tourism and immigration to Illinois is substantially down in the months since President Trump came to power. So the thing that that I think is interesting is something that I was thinking, and now I can't think of it. So this is your cue to jump in. Don't you have a commercial or something to go to?
Charlie Myers and Rumana Hussein in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do overreported and underreported stories. You can jump in if you'd like. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Charlie Meyerson, and Rumana Hussein in studio tonight. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text, you can call in. As we're reloading this week's news, what were the biggest stories? Overreported, underreported, winners, losers. Which story sucked you down the rabbit hole this week, and which story will we remember in 500 years? All right, so let's get to the overreported and underreported, and then we'll get to winners and losers. overreported. I'll start. I truly believe the Kathy Griffin stuff is overreported. I agree.
I believe
that she got the correct amount of punishment for doing it, essentially what turns into a joke that was in bad taste and form. But the idea that we let these comedians and these comedians, but we let them sort of somehow become the spokespeople for political movements. And Kathy Griffin somehow represents the left, or on the right, it was Ted Nugent, you know, with Barack Obama. But they're looking for attention. They know how to, you know, work the system, and we give it to them. And I just feel at a certain point, and even today with the press conference, although kind of interesting when it comes to precedent and what it means to tweet and take away someone's financial opportunity. But you know, I just felt at the end of the day that story it's just overreported.
Well, one of my friends on Facebook, when I shared an article about that, said, "Who's Kathy Griffin?" I mean, she is, you know,
which is a reminder.
She's from Oak Park, I know that. But it's a reminder to a lot of people. I mean, if you don't watch certain cable channels at certain times, and a lot of people don't, she's now more famous than she was.
Right. I do wonder, though. And the one thing I will take away from that overreported story is today her point being that if the president tweets at you and is it bullying, does she lose economic opportunity because she's had shows canceled, she gets fired from CNN. It's different when you're in a argument with a celebrity on Twitter. You can have that argument, kind of Donald Trump and Rosie O'Donnell come to mind. But when Donald Trump is the president and he continues that argument, does he own too much weight in a Twitter battle that could actually harm somebody's career?
With this president, not.
Yeah.
I mean, this president's tweets have so little currency. Do you think she got fired because he tweeted? No, I think
yes.
This is.
I think it was a backlash because there were people on the left and there were people on the right. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that if you're offended by this, and then they're showing all these pictures of, you know, effigies that people had of Obama with the noose around his neck, they're like, well, why wouldn't you be offended by that? And, you know, people are saying, well, that would be criticized as well. But I guess, like, when you look at people like Ted Nugent, like, he's not really on a TV show, so what are you going to cancel about him? But he said equally offensive things.
But I mean, that's the thing.
I just wonder
if it's a different, if it's a Obama, there's, it's
Obama's
not,
never going to be in a Twitter
right,
battle.
That's what I mean. It's
anybody.
Apples to apples in the way that you're like, if Obama came out and said, I can't believe you, Ted Nugent, you're a disgrace, you should be ashamed of yourself, my family is upset with what you posted on Facebook.
I don't think that Trump's tweet in this context was the deciding factor. As Stephen Colbert said, when Trump finally came out and acknowledged Colbert's criticism and condemned him, Colbert said, I win. You acknowledge my existence. I'm a winner.
Right, right.
So it's almost a badge of honor at this point for the president to condemn you on Twitter. I think in this case, if I were CNN, and I don't know what CNN's rationale was in its entirety, but, you know, there's really no upside for them in having her continue to do a New Year's Eve show. And I suspect that decision might have come down even if the president hadn't tweeted his outrage.
It is interesting. I mean, it's for as much that is made of how sensitive our country has become. And this was a big rallying point and a big moment in the campaign. Trump talked about it. His followers talked. They've come up with nicknames for the left, snowflakes and other things like that.
I like snowflakes.
but the idea that when there is somebody who does something, it's a little bit closer to the line in this PC culture, which was really rallied against in the Trump campaign. They are hurt. I mean, I think of this SNL writer who made the joke about Trump's son. I think about this thing that there is this strange paradoxical, I would say even hypocritical reaction to when a comedian says something that's too close to bashing Trump than the way that his followers sort of react to it.
Yeah, I think there's more of a climate where people get fired left and right. I mean, I think when Bill Clinton was running, wasn't there an SNL skit where Chelsea Clinton was depicted like a little pig? And I don't think there was any fallout. I mean, there was no Twitter at the time. There was no social media.
Right.
You know, now it's like when something is out there, everybody can just go on Twitter and start talking about it. A hashtag can be created. And, you know, shows have been canceled because of this. So, you know, you can definitely start a campaign on Twitter, which you couldn't do 20, 30 years ago.
Michelle Obama's advice seems more apt than ever. You know, when they go low, we go high. And I think in this environment, those who want to win over hearts and minds in their criticism of President Trump, are going to have to be on their game and go high.
All right, Charlie, what do you got for overreported?
Tiger Woods' arrest.
Yeah.
I thought, and I think this is true in general of mugshots, but as I considered whether to include that mugshot in Chicago Public Square, I decided not. It was just it's just a cheap shot. Anytime somebody's arrested and not charged, or arrested and not convicted, to run those mugshots, those are people, as people smarter than I have said, who are at the low point of their existence, and to blast that photo out, I think is unfair to him. And as much as, you know, Schadenfreude, a word that I know is near and dear to your heart, is something that appeals to all of us when we see someone high and mighty like Tiger Woods brought low. It just, the photo itself seemed unfairly publicized, especially as the story has emerged that it apparently wasn't, you know, alcohol.
It's prescription drugs.
It was prescription drugs, which, you know, for the, you know, but
it's
for
driving
the luck
while
of
impaired,
the gods,
but
we might all wind up. Yeah.
But the argument can be made, I guess, is if it's like a regular average Joe and they're arrested for something, their mugshot gets pasted. And I guess
I don't think that should be happening either until someone's convicted. And then ideally, even
what about
then,
somebody like Jason Van Dyke?
I don't think you run a mugshot of him. I mean, you get a photo of him. Again, hasn't
courts,
been convicted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And for everyone, we should explain Jason Van Dyke is the cop charged
with shooting Laquan McDonald. And I think in his case, I don't even think, you know, cops are always hesitant to putting out mugshots of police officers who do get arrested. But I think it did take some time, but we did get it and we did use it. So I think that's interesting that you said that, but I think Tiger Woods might have made some joke while his mugshot was being taken. I think they asked him what color his hair was and he said brown, but, you know, sparse, or like I'm losing it or something. That's what somebody said.
If he was impaired at the time, it just doesn't seem fair to take a picture.
It's absolutely true, though. It colored that story in the way that I remember. I went to Google News the day that it came out, and it was the thing that shot up, and that mugshot was in my face, and I was like, oh, what happened with Tiger Woods? And
that's the same thing
DUI,
I thought, too.
And it was the whole thing, and then you're right. As it went out a little bit, you're like, not that it was great that he's behind the wheel. He shouldn't be when he's impaired, but it's not as nefarious as the headlines in the mugshot led us to believe at the beginning. What do you got, Romana, for overreported?
Well, when I said overreported, I think it's overshared on social media. I think it's the new Nutella cafe that's open. I love Nutella, actually. I had an argument with somebody in the newsroom a couple days ago about how Nutella is better than peanut butter. Me and another reporter thought Nutella was better. And then that same day, they announced it was going to be a Nutella cafe.
Right.
It's just that everybody's talking about it, and it's definitely interesting, and the lines are long. I've just seen way too much about it, and I've read way too much about it.
It's right here on Michigan Avenue, and it feels like on my social media feeds, every fourth picture is a picture of a line outside of the store.
Yes, that's what I'm seeing, too. I mean, I think I am curious about it, but I don't think it's going to be months before I actually walk in there. I'll just get some Nutella from the grocery store.
With an electronics store, chocolate store.
Donut store.
But the idea that there's so much hubbub over a store with a line. It is, in my mind, I agree, it's overreported.
And I've never had Nutella. I don't think I've ever had it.
That's good for our Never Have I Ever. We do that Thursday nights, Charlie. Okay, Charlie Myers.
I'd rather come on a Thursday than a Friday, by the way. I was hoping someday you'd wrap up the week on a Thursday.
You're a Friday guy for us. Okay. Charlie Myers and Romano Hussein in studio. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do underreported and get to the winners and losers. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Romana Hussein. She is an assistant metro editor at Chicago Sun-Times. Charlie Meyerson, the editor and what would you call it, proprietor?
Proprietor.
Proprietor.
I like that. Proprietor.
Chicago Public Square, which you can sign up for, the daily newsletter and website, chicagopublicsquare.com.
Exactly right. Thank you. Check's in the mail.
It's a title.
That's right.
It wasn't an endorsement. It was a title.
But you endorsed it earlier.
I just said I read it.
That's close enough. I'll take that.
All right. 312-981-7200. We are reloading this week's news. We are to the underreported stories. Let's get into underreported. Why don't we start? Mike is on the line. And I want to bring Mike in because Mike shares one of the stories that we were just talking about in the break. Mike, what's your story for? You have it for actual loser, but let's talk about the story.
I'm basically calling it about the killing that happened in Oregon with the white supremacist that killed the two guys that basically stood up for the two Muslim women. And I guess it was, to me, it was a loser, not so much how it was underreported or anything. It was just how many, not necessarily you, Justin, but just many outlets that I was listening to were essentially quick to blame or assign blame to the president and his tone. And that was the cause, or that led to this man, you know, going off on tirade, right, and ultimately to
the analysis. I see what you think, Mike. The analysis of that going to the president. I mean, at a certain point, you have to be able to be accountable for your own actions.
Mm-hmm.
And there has been a lot of talk about how the president's rhetoric and tone has sort of fanned the flames of hate and racism. But Mike might have a point there in the idea that I'm not sure that President Trump has anything to do with this one.
Well, this is definitely a story. I mean, as a Muslim American, it's something that a lot of my friends have been talking about because, you know, these stories do touch us. And, you know, we do notice that I think there was a Muslim guy that was trying to, like, do something in Paris, France, and then he got shot down. And, you know, Trump tweeted about it. But, you know, he's always slow to tweet about white guys who are attacking,
right,
minorities.
That's definitely,
so I think a lot of people do bring that up. But yeah, everybody's responsible. I mean, there is this, you know, debate about whether, you know, Trump is emboldening certain people to go against, you know, minorities, religious minorities or ethnic, you know, minorities or people of color. But I think it was a story. I a lot of people that I know, being a Muslim and being from that community, is something, a story that people are really paying attention to. And, you know, the two victims, I think there's an update to the story, because I think one of the men that was killed, I think while he was there lying, I think somebody stole his wedding ring
right,
and his
bag.
Backpack.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
them,
the story,
right,
is continuing. Yeah, yeah. The guy was in court this week and, you know, obviously the commentary he made. So it's definitely people are responsible, but, you know, of course, the rhetoric is out there, too.
I would say the president is not blameless in this. And given that there are people in this society who are already and always will be on the edge, unpredictable in their behavior, easily influenced in their behavior, they get signals, whether they have foil on their heads or not.
You're right.
And no, I don't believe that one can, you know, indict the president for this particular case. But I do think that his campaign and his presidency have created an environment where people who are living on the knife's edge are going to fall off very easily.
I would make a correlation to his predecessor as well, because the right has always spoken up about how President Obama has, especially when it comes to law enforcement,
mm-hmm,
has made the police the aggressor and the communities the spoke for communities, not police officers, and he's emboldened the Black Lives Matter movement. And we've heard that. I'm saying that's what's been heard from the right, the idea that, you know, the president sends these signals. So it's the same concept of, you know, is this president sending signals?
Well, with this, it's like, you know, there are specific groups that have been targeted by this administration. You know, look at something like the Muslim ban, what people call, you know, the travel ban. It is targeting a certain group of people, and, you know, the rhetoric is targeted towards a certain group of people. So when you have the president of the United States saying certain things about certain groups, yeah, he's not responsible for the actions of every,
right,
single person, but this is the leader of your country saying things that aren't really necessarily positive about a certain group. So I think in a way it does make people realize, like, hey, it's okay to do this. And I think hate crimes have increased against certain groups. You know, we had the, you know, even against Jewish groups and different other groups, not
we
just Muslims.
That, yeah. Well, Ruman, let's go to your underreported story, because I agree with you entirely. You know, when it comes to some of the issues that if they happened in more westernized countries, and we talk about terrorist attacks, mm-hmm, or bombings, things like that, we get candlelight vigils and tribute concerts. And if it happens in America, you know, forever coverage. Bombing in Kabul this week didn't get much, if just sort of like a blip in the news.
And for me, that was one of the most underreported stories. And when I say underreported, we do have reporters,
sure,
actually covering the story.
Just the
it's
way
been
it was
covered.
Accepted. Yeah,
but yeah, yeah, like, is it front page news for us? No. Whereas if something happened in France or England, it's on front page. People's Facebook filters change. And, you know, that I'm just saying, as a person of color and as someone who has ties to, you know, places that aren't necessarily in Europe, it's interesting how people react to different, you know, whether the victims were non-Muslim or if they're white, as opposed to whether they're Muslim. And people,
absolutely,
think this is like, oh, this happens all the time in these countries. And that's not necessarily true. I think there was an attack in Brussels. I think about a year and a half ago, and it made the front page news. And I thought it was interesting because maybe 2 years ago, there was an attack in a school in Pakistan. And I think there was a large number of kids that were killed, and it was not a front page story. I can guarantee you there's more Pakistani Americans in Chicago than there are people from Brussels.
It always blows my mind. And I would say that that story specifically, the bombing in Kabul, was a very it was a stylized kind of bombing.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was somebody in a water delivery truck,
yeah,
I think.
It was very strange way that they did it, and very scary.
And it was by embassies too, right. So it was supposed to be in a safe zone. So it's definitely, you know, and I know people think Afghanistan, which is how I pronounce it, but Afghanistan, people think it's, you know, oh, it's always been in war, it's always been turmoil, but you know, there's victims there too. And that's what I always find interesting. Whenever there's a terrorist attack, people always think that, oh, it's the West getting attacked, but I'm like, you know, Muslims are probably the number one victims, yeah, of terrorist attacks. And I just wish that more people were paying attention to it. So I don't think it was an underreported story. I think it's a story that people weren't paying attention to as much as I think they should have.
Charlie, what do you got for underreported?
Well, the clock is ticking on this deal under which the Chicago Tribune's parent company, Trunk, can acquire the Chicago Sun-Times, where Romana works, yeah, and the Chicago Reader, and maybe, is there other properties involved? I think those are the two big ones.
Yeah.
They extended the deadline.
They've extended the deadline.
Yes, because they said for interested buyers.
And we're kind of at a disadvantage in that the two organizations that are at the center of this story are the two organizations that more often than not, those of us who aren't in those organizations would count on to be digging into this story and tell us what's going on. Who are the players? Who's making the bids?
Right.
And we haven't seen.
That's a great point.
I haven't seen a lot about, you know, what these movements are. Who are the players who have expressed interest?
We saw a couple stories. We saw Natasha Kurecki had a story this week in Politico about who there was sort of anonymous bidders that were coming up.
Exactly.
Two or three,
mm-hmm,
bidders that weren't Trunk. Robert Feeders had a lot saying that the Sun-Times staff and editorial staff was worried about there being a monopoly in town and was pushing against
this. With good reason.
Sure. But there was definitely, but you're absolutely right. The idea that the two major papers, the major news organizations, because of conflict of interest, and mm-hmm, have had to recuse themselves essentially, and we don't get the news.
I don't know that they've had to, because, you know, I worked for the Chicago Tribune at the time when it was sold to Sam Zell, and there was, back then, what I would call fearless reporting on what was going on. They, you know, they had a firewall up between the reporting on the purchase and the editors who were actually in the executives, the company, who were involved in the negotiations. And I just haven't seen any of that this time. The sort of, where are the reporters who are digging in on this story, who have been given independence by their corporate overlords to dig in on the story? Who are the players? Who's interested in buying? Who's slowing it down? What are the prospects? There really have only been, you know, a couple of inflection points on, yeah, this story, and mm-hmm, nothing in between.
I mean, we just had a story, I think, when it was announced. We had one reporter, yeah, covering it. But, I mean, I can tell you from the Sun-Times point of view, it's like we don't have any reporters left to do the digging, you know? So it's like we're just trying to do the everyday story. So when we hear about something like this, we've had a pretty rough last couple of years, you know, starting in 2008 with the layoffs. And I think, you know, the mood at the paper is like, you know, we're just going to work hard. You know, we definitely asked questions about this, you, yeah, know, when it was announced, when Jim Kirk announced this, and, you know, we listened, and we probably know as much as anybody else knows. And we just figure we just keep going. But yeah, there is that fear. Like, will this eventually be just a one paper town?
I'm here to cheer you on and say, put a reporter on this and
yeah,
do some digging and be the ones to tell us who's involved.
You know, Scott Smith was on earlier. We were talking local media this week. And the price in which the Chicago Sun-Times was staying, somewhere at $5 million, $3 million, whatever it is. I mean, it's such a far cry from what it was. But does that open the door? And I'll ask Charlie this, as mm-hmm, Romana can recuse herself. But does that open the door for a philanthropist, for,
yes,
a tech startup, for someone to go, $5 million, that's nothing?
Yeah, it does.
It's not a done deal that it's Trunk.
Michael Farrow, who, yeah, right, heads Trunk, the Tribune, right, the Chicago Tribune's parent company. I mean, that's him. We got lots of other rich people in Chicago. I look at what Jeff Bezos has done, you know, the Amazon mogul who purchased the Washington Post. He has done some amazing things, or allowed his staff to do some amazing things, because from what I understand, he's taken a hands-off approach. The Washington Post has become, mm-hmm, for me at least, my go-to source for reporting on the Trump campaign, even more so than the New York Times, partly because the firewall is a little more porous and they're focused on gaining an internet audience. Someone with pocket change really for these gazillionaires could come in and duplicate what he has done, and there's great potential to serve the Chicago market and make money.
Charlie Meyerson, Ramana Hussein in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to do winners and losers. Sound good? Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. You can text or you can call in. All right, let's get to winners and losers. We never want to talk about the winners. We just want to talk about the losers.
Yeah, right? I like Charlie about winners.
Ramana Hussein in studio. Who you got for winners, Charlie?
Al Franken.
Why
Al Franken? Has been unleashed. You know, as I imagine many people know, he's a Saturday Night Live veteran who's now a senator from Minnesota and has been for many years. And a lot of people have been waiting for him to be funny in Congress, his fans anyway. But he's got a new book out called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. In which he kind of lets loose in ways that he's going to Lit Fest.
He's going to be at Lit Fest next week for Printer's Row.
Well, you know, I'm a fan of his comedic work, and I think as a senator, he's been fascinating to watch. And now that this book is out, basically it's, and I haven't read the book yet, but it's a compilation of all the jokes that he wishes he could have said but didn't. For instance, inclined to be funny, this is an anecdote I read. When he first came to the Senate, he was pushing through a group of tourists and said, "Excuse me, more important than you. Excuse me, more important than you." and he realized, you know, after someone called him out for it, that, you know, that might be funny if you weren't a senator. But when you are a senator, that kind of stuff just doesn't
work.
And yet now he seems to be trying some of this material out.
Yeah. Senators don't have a great track record for making fun of themselves.
And of course, the question is this an indication that he might consider running for president? He's, of course, as all candidates would do, saying no.
Well, you know, it's funny because I would have said, "Oh, no way, can you have an entertainer?" But then I'm like, "Well, what are we talking about?"
Trump has blown away all the barriers to decorum that we would normally expect.
It'd be fun, I guess. Only if he did his. Remember, he was he played Paul Simon, Senator Paul Simon from Illinois, in all of the sketches in the 80s.
Oh, he did.
For Saturday Night Live. Well,
I just remember him at the Stuart Smiley. Was it
Smalley? Yeah.
Smartly, yeah. I just remember that one.
Stuart Smalley, yeah. And one of the bits that he did that I use in my journalism classes is the thing he did where he was a one-man band reporter at a time when it was impractical. He had a big satellite dish on his head and very heavy equipment. Yeah. And, of course, now you can do it all with your smartphone.
Yeah, he was ahead of the time. All right, Ramona, let's go right to losers. I mean, we had other winners, too, and we'll get to those in other parts of the reload. But we got to talk Springfield. I mean, this was the big story. It came very close in my mind to being the biggest story of the week, beat out by the Paris Accord. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I ask you both, I mean, who wins, who loses? I mean, politically. I mean, last week it was, you know who loses? The taxpayers. All right,
well,
let's put that to the side. Who won? Did the Democrats win or did the Republicans win by not getting enough for the 700 plus days of no budget?
You know, from the continuous times I've been reading, we had at the Sun-Times, we had 702 days without a budget and we finally stopped. We had a countdown on, I don't know if you noticed on the paper. So it was 702 yesterday and we stopped today because, the session is over. But I guess in this instance, if you're just going to look at it, it's Bruce Rauner, right? Winning, it's kind of like you're hearing this over and over again. I feel like it's a broken record. Like, I know it's the biggest story of the week, but as someone who, deals with the news every day and someone who consumes the news,
it doesn't change
much. I feel like the stories I read feel like a broken record, but I think Bruce Rauner probably is the winner in this instance.
Well, Bruce Rauner definitely making the rounds today. I mean, he was on Cochran this morning. He's out and about and he's, talking about how what a disaster, what tragedy, failure of the Democrats. I don't hear too many Democrats. I mean, State Senate President John Cullerton was on as well, I heard. But, I mean, he seems to be wanting to talk about this mess where you don't hear much from Mike Madigan.
Well, that's Michael Madigan's modus operandi, which is not to talk. So that's, I don't know if that means that he's a winner or a loser in this context. But I'd agree with Ramana that, I think given all the factors that were in play, this seems to be the outcome that Governor Rauner wanted. He could have had a budget. He could have compromised. He has, as indicated, no willingness to compromise. It's his way or no way. And he wound up, and the Tribune, I believe, had an in-depth article this morning or yesterday about how he manipulated things so that he would not be sent a budget. Because he doesn't want a budget, not on the record, is vetoing.
Let me ask you this, though. I mean, politically, and this is a war. This is not a battle.
Oh, yeah.
And these two parties have gone at each other in each step, trying to force the other one to get on the record to do something different, to do something that they can use. I mean, you saw right away. I mean, it was. I think Rich Miller was saying, 6 hours after the fact, they were robocalls about the Democrats want a tax hike and they didn't get another budget done. But the point, I guess, at the end of the day, is it is a war, and we focusing on the battle of another budget that didn't happen. But I mean, there's still a long way to go to, I guess, what's the end? I don't know what's the end.
Yeah,
goal
I don't know. And I think
point,
I think taxpayers are getting frustrated too. I think we had a story in the paper. Tina Svandelis, our political reporter, had a story about how people are going on these like lawmakers' Facebook pages and just getting so angry at the these lawmakers for not coming up with the budget, and just saying how they're frustrated and they're taking and lashing out at them. So mm-hmm. it's getting interesting. I think people are just fed up in general.
The one thing you wonder,
I'm tired of listening.
Political strategy. I mean, it's pretty great. I will say, for as bad as lawmakers they are. Down in Springfield, they're pretty brilliant politicians in the way that they are both making moves to make the other one look bad. But at the end of the day, if the goal is the governor's mansion, Mike Madigan and company can run on the fact in 2018 that the governor accomplished nothing. There was not one budget in the 4 years. He was not able to lead the state to a balanced budget, to any of the structural reforms that he wanted. He did nothing. Now, will the taxpayers believe that?
Your guess is as good as mine. Yeah. After this last election in particular, I make no predictions at all. I avoid making predictions at all costs. We shall see. Only time will tell.
I'll say on the other side, too, because I don't want to sound biased, but I'm like, and Democrats, too, because we just said the mm-hmm. Democrats didn't put a budget forward. They are on the hook. And not only that, Bruce Rauner and the Republicans forced them to show their hand, which was a massive income tax hike. So now you've set up what each party's weakness is as we get ready for a 2018 election among billionaires.
I think that a massive income tax increase, and it's your word, not mine, massive there, is something that might not prove as unpopular as some people think. That if one can make a case that taxes are being increased for those who can most afford to pay it, that the income tax is the most equitable way to improve Illinois' situation. And I think there is a lot of, I suspect, there's a lot of voter support to be found for someone who can advance a plan, and it's been tried and tried again. Don Clark Netsch, decades ago, tried it and was shot down. But the idea that the income tax, unlike the property tax, which continually rises whether your income rises or not, that an income tax which fluctuates with your ability to pay on a year-to-year basis is the most fair, most equitable way to fund state government.
Right, you pay more if you make more.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know why there's such objection to that, or and why people would think
I think
there'd
people
be such
just hear taxes and your taxes being raised. They don't necessarily think, the calculations into it. So I think just people hear that and they automatically say no, shut it down. But I don't know. It'd be interesting. Like you said, you never know what people would be interested in to get a balanced budget.
I just think it's great politics. It's terrible for the taxpayers of Illinois, but it is great politics to watch both of these leaders in the party try to put the other one in a box.
And meanwhile, people are dying. Children in particular are mm-hmm. dying. I think, again, this is another aspect of the state's budget problem is the Department of Children and Family Services. Yeah. It's continuing problems. The resignation of its leader this week.
And we're running out of time because we're coming up on the news. But that story, we haven't even had a chance to talk about. That one, I want to go down the rabbit hole because didn't taxpayers and Republicans nail Pat Quinn's wall back to the wall on the DCFS and the troubles they were having when he was governor? And here we are, not even 4 years later with Republican leadership and DCFS and the same problems exist. This is interesting that it seemed like there was much more Democrats are really ruining DCFS 4 years ago, and now it seems to... I mean, this is like the fourth or fifth leader in 18 months or something?
And, the problems that the state social workers are asked to deal with are horrific, and that's one that I think is suffering, that problem, that front is suffering because the state doesn't have the money to put into it.
Ramana Hussein, Charlie Meyerson in studio. We are breaking down this week's news, or reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We'll come back. We'll talk about which stories sucked us down the rabbit hole and which stories will be remembered 5, 10, 50, 500 years from this week. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's a download, 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman. Ramana Hussein, the assistant metro editor at Chicago Sun-Times. Charlie Meyerson of Chicago Public Square. In studio, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Before we get to the rabbit hole story and which story will be remembered from this week, let's go to the text line. 815 says, I'm not interested in higher taxes. Absolutely ludicrous. When the morons in Springfield can control their spending, no new taxes. You can't keep coming after the taxpayers for your stupidity.
Not even the rich taxpayers?
And, you know, Eric Zorn had a piece this week that I thought was really, really enlightening.
I was going to mention this.
The idea that Illinois, the state of Illinois, spending, and the governor likes to mention this, that spending's out of whack, the high-spending Democrats in Illinois, it is in line and below the Illinois, or the United States average when it comes to spending and how big the government is in Illinois.
And to our listener who just texted, I wonder if this person would be against higher income taxes if it were accompanied by lower property taxes.
That's, yeah. 773, no more taxes. I think that you might have hit on something, Romano, when you're like, the word tax.
Yeah.
Because you're right. If you pay more, you should pay more taxes. That's
makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But I'm not an elected official.
815 says the Senate did pass a budget with revenue to the House. I know, but the budget did not get out of the House. That's what we're saying. So there's a couple more things in here just about their companies are offering insurance in case of Trump attacks or other social media fiascos now. It's interesting.
I should look into that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so, you know, let's get to the rabbit hole story. This is the story that you took a little bit more time. You got into, spent more time reading and understanding the story than just sort of regurgitating.
I'm not sure
the
that's
headlines.
Possible yeah, in right. the case of the story I'm thinking.
Romana,
of.
Your story is one that I saw the headlines on, and I didn't go any further. Mm-hmm. But it has a little hometown feel for you.
Yeah, this is the attack of the Uber driver that happened Tuesday morning, and the young person that got charged with the crime was a 16-year-old girl. And it was an interesting case because it happened in Lincolnwood, and that's only a couple blocks. The incident actually happened only a couple blocks away from where I grew up. So I thought it was a pretty interesting story just because so many people are driving Uber or, like, you know, taking people around just for extra money. And you never think you're going to, you know, you hear cases where the Uber driver is the one attacking
yeah,
someone,
right,
but you
right.
have heard very little stories about.
Because at the end of the day, you're tracked and it's you're on the phone, and there's a little bit of security in the fact that it's not an anonymous crime.
Yeah, and this definitely was one of those cases where it was random because this young woman, according to prosecutors, had gotten to three Uber drivers that day. This was a third victim within a couple hours, early Tuesday morning. She first had an Uber driver take her to a train station, I think, in Des Plaines. Then she went to a Walmart not
too
far. Did
she do it? Did she attack on the first one? No.
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 And then she ordered another Uber driver to take her to a Walmart not too far from the crime scene. And then she actually shoplifted a knife and a machete. And nobody stopped her. She was caught on camera, but she just walked out of a Walmart, unwrapped the weapons. And this young man from Wilmette ended up picking her up. And within 2 minutes, prosecutors said that he was attacked and he ended up dying. And she was found by police officers in Lincolnwood nearby because she tried to take the car and the car ended up crashing into a median. And then she was hiding in the corner. So, you know, I'm sure there's people thinking.
I mean, we're way ways from trials and things like that. But is there motivation for this, or is this random and senseless?
Said, you know, they said that they didn't talk to police officers, but the judge during the bond hearing, because I did edit the story at least for the Sun-Times, he said that, you know, this was a random act. And it was just a very tragic yeah. story because there was this young man. I think he, you know, did some acting and worked in the restaurant business and had a lot of friends and just was trying to make an extra living. And,
you know, you get desensitized to Uber taxi stories and altercations between the passengers and the drivers because it happens so much and frequently. And like you said, usually the other way around. But as a consumer, I always will see that story and put it into the crime blotter and move on. But
yeah.
You're right, once you get deeper into it, it's crazy to think like that.
The older I get, the more I'm inclined to tip drivers more generously.
Mm-hmm.
It's an often thankless task and is a dangerous one. This an extreme case, but it's you know, you're meeting strangers all the time and you're getting into an enclosed space with them
yeah.
where they could do anything.
Yeah. Charlie, what do you got for the rabbit hole story of the week?
Covfefe, which is how I pronounce it. And if you pronounce it some other way, you're wrong.
I called it coffee-fee.
President Trump's, I really don't know how it's pronounced. I'm not sure.
Some people thought it was, say it's Arabic.
It was fascinating. And for those who don't know, I guess we should explain. It apparently was the president's tweeted typo for the word coverage.
Spicer said it wasn't a typo, or he said it wasn't.
When's the last time Sean Spicer said something that was true?
Another weird story this week.
But the aspects of the story were many and varied, including the fact it's now been added, apparently. I haven't had a chance to test it yet, to the Words with Friends dictionary, so you can use that. That would be a lot of points, because V is 5 points, I think. Yeah. F is 4 points. That would be, and if you have a triple letter score in there, or a triple word, could be a real bonanza of a word.
It happened that night, and we were on the air when it happened, and Pete and I, right after the show, we were sitting at our desk, and you know, I had TweetDeck up on my computer, and I remember saying it to him, like, I've never seen my feed be one topic and every tweet coming in, because it's varied, it's all over, and it'd be a lot of different things, but this just captured social media so quickly and like wildfire that it was the hottest and overreported and underreported and crazy and winner and loser all in one for about 12 hours.
And then it sat. Yeah. We have yet to get an explanation of why it sat there for 6 hours or so before the president or someone deleted it, and then the president made a joke about it. What was he thinking?
Maybe it was Twitter fingers and he just a typo, but you would think that he didn't finish it. I agree.
It was an incomplete sentence, even if you assume it was the word coverage. Well, what about it?
When I initially saw the word, I can tell you, I thought I was stupid because I was like, is this something I'm supposed to know? Or like, what is that word? And I was like, oh my God, I'm like, it's probably some word I have no idea. It's right. Like maybe some sort of agreement or like, you know, in instead of the Paris Agreement, this is something else he came up with. And then I realized it was a Twitter mistake.
How many people have now adopted that as their password? I wonder.
Oh, there have been like videos on how to make confetti or however it's pronounced, and it's like coffee, but then like somebody goes crazy and like, you know, there's been a lot of jokes and people are making
Hillary Clinton's response. Yeah, you all saw that.
Right. No, what
people,
did she say?
People who live in confetti houses shouldn't throw confetti.
That's awesome.
I have two stories that went down the rabbit hole, both pretty mainstream stories, but one, which I think was tremendous, was J.B. Pritzker being on the Blagojevich tapes. Mm-hmm. I thought if there's one thing that you cannot do when you're running as a Democrat in the state of Illinois for governor is to be in the same breath or on tape with Governor Rod Blagojevich. I just feel like at a certain point, like that's become the political notebook. Everyone has tried to stay away from it. You see everybody from even Pat Quinn, who was lieutenant governor. Everyone is moved away from as far as they can, and then the new hope for the Democrats running for governor, voila, a tape surfaces where he is talking to the governor.
Yeah, there's your campaign ad, your opposition ad for 2018.
And I guess what really grabbed my attention was that specific tape was a tape that was not permissible in the court, was one that was stricken from the record. It had nothing to do. They had done a lot of lawyering during that time, if you remember, and there were a lot of tapes that were thrown out and ones that were permissible, ones that weren't. That wasn't, it leaked to the Tribune. They were able to release it. But in that tape, you hear something that was never heard before, and you do hear a little bit more of Governor Blagojevich in his sort of conniving ways, the ways that have been debated for the last 5 years now about whether or not he got too hard of a sentence. Can you put someone in jail for thinking about doing it? There's all those kind of thoughts, and I thought this showed a side of Governor Blagojevich that was not very flattering and kind of doubled down on the fact that this guy had one idea, and that was to sell the seats and whatever he can get for it. So I just felt like that was kind of the takeaway from that story was hearing Rod Blagojevich in the moment from years ago, you know, from almost 10 years ago now. It's crazy.
Pritzker's, you know, definitely a contender for the loser category this week.
Yeah. And the other one, and this is one that I know that people get mad at me at talking about the Russia story. The Putin's interview, which I thought was really interesting, where he was saying that he almost likens it to anti-Semitism, the way that the Russians have been beaten up by the Americans in this. And then he talked about that it's not necessarily, maybe it's not Russia, but it's, you know, a hacker from Russia That was the other thing. And then the third was, and this is a very small story that kind of came and went, but was about Attorney General Jeff Sessions and an NBC report that said, again, a source, mm-hmm. a leak, someone putting out that they're being investigated for a third possible meeting Attorney General wow. Jeff Sessions had during the campaign. It was in April of 2016, which is on the, people knew about it. That could have been private, and more importantly, was not. He didn't tell people about it. And when you think about what happened, you mentioned Al Franken, the confirmation hearings, where he said he never met with any Russian officials. Then he came back. Oh, I forgot about that one. Then he came back again. Oh, I forgot about that second. Now it's possible to go. Oh, I thought I there's a third. And I already got someone 708 saying, can we just please move on? And I get the concept of that notion. But the question I continue, and Jared Kushner's story in the New York mm-hmm. Times this week, is the idea that if this is nothing and we need to move on and it's just a conspiracy on the left because Hillary Clinton lost and everyone's mad, why are they lying and covering it up? And it continues to happen in this way that it can't – these are professional politicians. These are professional lawmakers. They know they cannot be caught saying something that's not true under oath, yet they're doing it. And I'm confused. When you say, can we just move on, I'm confused why the Trump administration won't let us.
And that's a story that's going to keep going.
Yeah.
I think it should.
Because I don't necessarily
think
there's collusion. I'm not sure, as an enlightened consumer, I'm like, oh, okay, it could be anything. I don't know what's happening, but it's interesting to watch how much cover-up there's been.
This is what some people in the journalism profession refer to as a turn of the screw story. And there are many turns and probably many screws in this story. And it's going to be hard, I think, for journalists and for members of the public to get really excited about any one turn or any one screw until...
Yeah, there's a painted
where's
picture,
the metaphor
right,
go from
right,
here?
Right.
I'm not sure.
I know what
everything's
mean,
all screwed up.
So it's an IKEA dresser.
Exactly. There you go. Thank you. So we all should be incredibly grateful to the reporters who are out there with their screwdrivers, and I'm going to drop the metaphor at this point, doing the hard work that is revealing these things bit by bit, and the prosecutors and the government investigators who are now also working on a parallel path, and at some point. Maybe we'll get to the truth, which the administration does not seem inclined to reveal.
Yeah, now there's going to be no more questions on Russia. It's going to go through lawyers. There's not even going to be daily briefings. I mean, it gets to a certain point where I guess you can go to Twitter and you could say it's a witch hunt and you can say that this is just because sour grapes. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, you look at it and you say, but then why are there so many mistruths?
On the daily briefings? they weren't weren't that useful.
All right. Charlie Myers and Ramana Hussein in studio. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we will give our stories of what's going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this week. Stay with us. I should have said that the rabbit hole story is I am in the middle of for Litfest. We're talking about this on the show. I'm for fun. There's so many great authors that are coming and, they only come to Chicago for one weekend a year. I booked 8 of them.
Wow. Who?
I've got Sachi Cool, who's the BuzzFeed.
Yeah, she's all. Yeah.
Samantha Irby. Mark Bowden, who I'm reading his book now. He's the guy who wrote Black Hawk Down, and it's Hue 1968. It's about the Battle of Hue in South Vietnam right at the Tet Offensive. It's phenomenal. Mm. And that's the rabbit hole because I've read 250 pages in a day. And this is like that's all I've been doing. So I feel like if you want to stay, we could stay for like an hour, and we can just talk about what the first one.
Did you read all the books?
I try. Yeah.
How was the Cole book?
I've only gone 2 essays in, and it's good.
It's good. I've heard about it.
Yeah, it's good. She's got an older boyfriend.
Yeah.
That's all.
How much older?
She doesn't say, but he says she always makes jokes that he's just about to die.
Do you find the interview goes better when you actually have read the whole book? Or do you find that you go down the rabbit hole and it becomes more about you're trying to impress the author that you've read the book as opposed to bringing the audience in?
The problem I have is that if it's a novel and it's something that people haven't read, you just end up talking about things that are particular to what you've read. So you're like, tell me about when Rachel finds the flower. and you're like, what? So that's a harder thing. But this book with the Hue 1968, I won't have that problem. It's a historical document. It's really, really good. And it has a lot of parallels to Afghanistan, to Iraq. It has a lot of parallels to the relationship between the U.S. government and the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's kind of interesting that the U.S. government at the time hates the New York Times and Washington Post because they are giving contradictory statements on the war and all sorts of stuff. So it's really
the natural state of things.
It is.
Really.
But, I mean,
is.
It makes you think, like, you know, LBJ was talking about the same concept of that these papers were unfair, and mm-hmm. it's the same stuff that Donald Trump's talking about today.
Yeah. The more recent period where there was relative peace between government and newspapers is the aberration across American history. Yeah. This is its more natural state.
Really?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about which stories we're going to be remembering from this week, 50, 100, 500 years from now. Charlie?
I got a curve to throw you.
Okay.
I think, you know, 50 years from now, it might be the Paris Accords. We'll see. I don't think 500 years from now, I'm skeptical that any of us will be here if something
doesn't
happen.
I don't think the Earth
happen.
Will be here, so that's why.
The Earth will
say.
Be here. I'm not sure if there'll be people here.
Maybe
but,
not.
But if there are still people here, I actually suspect that the word covfefe will still be in dictionaries
yes.
500 years from now.
So a new word. Wow, that's
I
good.
Think,
that's
I
good.
Think that's what we've given birth
Romano,
to this
what
week.
Do you got for stories?
I originally had said the pulling out of the Paris agreement, but I will also say the Beatles anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's coming
years,
out. It's
right.
50 years, so I think in 500 years people will still
be.
Remember that
wait,
it's
wait.
500 years.
Yeah. Are we going to remember the 50th anniversary? 500?
No, I guess
man, that 50-year anniversary
you
was a
what?
Great celebration.
I actually do remember the 20th anniversary because I was in high school and we had to learn about it. But
there you go.
So what your real prediction is for 500, 50
I'll remember,
years from
I'll
now.
Remember.
450 years
yeah,
from
maybe
now.
Maybe in 20 years.
20
years, I'll remember talking about it
there you go.
On the radio.
Mine is much more cosmic. The way that NASA announced this week that they are going to be sending
oh, yeah.
a probe to the sun.
The Parker probe.
Named
I'm
after
afraid,
a U of C physicist,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that that's going to anger the sun. And in 150, 250 years, we'll be fighting the sun. We'll be a big war with the sun. I think that's what's going to happen. No, but I think something's going to happen with that probe. That we'll
are you apologizing for your prediction there?
Maybe we'll find out something's wrong with the sun. Maybe we'll find out that, oh, you know what? The sun's not a friend. Like, there's a lot that could happen with a probe to the sun. Maybe it's not as hot as we thought it
what
was.
What I want to know is, have we equipped this probe with lots of sunscreen?
Right.
I hope there's some on board.
I'm fascinated by the story, just with the idea that, I mean, I would assume that it's
the
transmitting.
The pictures are really cool. I don't know if you've seen the pictures. They're awesome.
I know. I wonder what's going to happen. But anyway. Charlie Meyerson, Chicago Public Square. You can sign up for the daily newsletter, which daily email, which goes out daily.
That's right.
And it's also on the reader poll for Best of Chicago. It's Best Newsletter. Is that what it is?
Best news site.
News
vote
site.
For us.
Vote for it.
Never
yeah.
mind those other guys. On that.
Romano Hussein is the assistant metro editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. You guys, thanks so much for joining us
Thank
tonight.
Thank you for
it was
having
great.
Us.
Thank you.